murder site, Saikaku went on, and subject them to intensive interrogation, a thorough and skillful interrogation, by which I mean there would be no evident marks on their bodies on their release. On their release? In other words, before we arrest them, you don't think a thorough and skillful interrogation will come up with anything?
I doubt that it will, Major Ayasu, Saikaku replied. But I think we have to try. We may find some information, perhaps nothing useful now, but useful to us later. Then we released the prisoners. By arresting them and then releasing them without serious physical harm, we will accomplish several things. First, we will establish our authority by the very act of arresting them. Second, they will learn, and may be counted on to pass on, just how uncomfortable a Kempeitai thorough and professional interrogation can be. And finally, by releasing them, we will prove that while we are firm, we are just.
Very interesting, Colonel Tange said. I wish to consider that at my leisure.
Everyone in the room understood that Colonel Tange's decision would look very much like what Captain Saikaku had suggested, either because that was what he had already come up with on his own, or because Saikaku's ideas seemed to be the best offered. But to make that announcement now would cause Major Ayasu to lose face.
You said Lieutenant Hideyori is outside, Captain Saikaku, Colonel Tange went on. Has he something to report?
No, sir. I spoke with him at length before I came here. Should the colonel desire, I am prepared to give a brief report on his failure. I ordered him to be here in case the colonel or Major Ayasu would like to talk with him personally.
Let's have the brief report, Tange ordered.
There have been fewer and fewer communications between Fertig and Australia. I alluded to this before. He asked for supplies, they replied that his request is being considered and give him a time for his next transmission. The time between such contacts seems to be growing longer. This, however, makes Lieutenant Hideyori's efforts to locate the transmitter much more difficult, as Fertig seems to be moving his transmitter after every exchange with Australia. He moves the transmitter within an area 30 miles wide east to west and 70 miles north to south, and always where there are few roads.
In other words, he's no closer to finding the transmitter than ever, Colonel Tange asked.
I regret that seems to be the case, Saikaku replied. Shall I send for him, Colonel?
In your judgment, is he doing everything he should be doing?
Yes, sir. He is. Then there's really no point in wasting my time talking to him, is there?
I would not think so, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen. That will be all, Colonel Tange said. Major Ayasu, would you please stay behind?
2. Rocky Fields Farm, Bernardsville, New Jersey, 16:15, 25 October, 1942. Miss Ernestine Sage stepped out of her bathroom stark naked in the process of toweling her hair, having decided it made sense to bathe now while her father and Ken McCoy were trying to fit in an hour or so of hunting before supper, rather than before she went to bed. As soon as dinner was over, she intended to announce that she was tired. They all had a busy day tomorrow, and why didn't everybody go to bed? 30 minutes after that, she planned to sneak as quietly as possible down the corridor past her parents' bedroom and into the guest bedroom. Ken would not expect her to do that, and it would be a pleasant, if discomforting, surprise for him. And she had no intention of going back to her bedroom, no matter what his protests. If her parents heard her, that would be unfortunate. She was not going to lose the opportunity to sleep with her man when she had the chance, no matter what the circumstances. She didn't want to be here anyway. Her father had shown up at her apartment in Manhattan early that morning and practically dragged both of them into his car to bring them here. She glanced idly out the window to see how dark it was, to make sure there was time to finish her toilet before they returned. Her father and Ken were perhaps 500 yards from the house, walking through the stubble of a cornfield, obviously headed for home. She'd thought she'd have at least half an hour, that they wouldn't return until it was really getting dark.
Oh, God, I hope Daddy didn't say anything to Ken that made him mad.
Damn, she said, and increased the vigor of her toweling. She dressed as quickly as she could, in a brown tweed skirt and a light green, high-collared sweater, slipped her bare feet into a pair of loafers, quickly applied lipstick, and went downstairs. She found them in the gun room. Ken was peering down the barrels of a shotgun. Her father was scrubbing the action of the gun with a toothbrush.
"Home are the hunters, home from the field," she said, "much sooner than expected."
"It didn't take long," Ernest Sage said, watching with what Ernie knew was discomfort as she went to Ken and kissed him. Ernest Sage was a slightly built, very intense man of 48 who wore his full head of black hair slicked back with Vita hair. Vita hair was one of the 209 widely distributed products of American Personal Pharmaceuticals, of which he was chairman of the board and chief executive officer.
"Tell me," Ernie said.
"We were 50 yards into the first field. Two cocks jumped up. Before I could get my gun up, Ken got both of them."
"He's a Marine, Daddy. What did you expect?"
"He's a hell of a shot, honey," Ernest Sage said. "I'll tell you that." Ernest Sage did not rise to the top of APP solely because he was the largest individual stockholder in the corporation founded by his grandfather, Ezekiel Handley, M.D., he thought of himself as an ordinarily competent, decently educated individual who had somehow acquired an ability to get people to do what he wanted them to do and to like doing it. Or the reverse, to not do what he thought they should not do and believe that not doing it was the logical and reasonable thing to do. He had often joked that there were only two people in the world he could not control, his wife and his only child. But even when he said that, he knew he had his wife pretty well under control. Ernie was the one who did what she wanted to do and didn't do what she didn't want to do, completely oblivious to the desires and manipulative efforts of her father. Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy, USMCR, obviously confirmed that perception. Ernest Sage often privately thought that if he compiled a list of undesirable suitors for his daughter's affections, right at the top of that list would be a Marine officer with an unpleasant family background. They didn't have a dime, was the way he thought of it. With only a high school education, whose only prospects were the near certainty of getting himself badly maimed in the war, or, more likely, killed. It deeply disturbed him, but didn't really surprise him, when Ernie told him that 30 minutes after she met Ken McCoy, she knew she wanted to marry him. Adding to his difficulties was the fact that he not only admired McCoy, but rather liked him. He could not even console himself with the thought that McCoy was after his and his daughter's money. Ernie would marry him at the drop of a hat, he knew, either with his permission or without it. McCoy refused to do that. He thought it would be unfair to leave her a widow or obliged to spend the rest of her life caring for a cripple. Since Ernie almost always got what she wanted, because she was willing to pay whatever the price might be, one of the unpleasant possibilities that Ernest Sage was forced to live with was that she would get herself in the family way, either as a bargaining chip to bring McCoy to the altar or, and with Ernie this was entirely possible, simply because she wanted to bear his child. He had discussed this subject with Ernie, and she had pointed out that any illicit fruit of their union would not wind up on public assistance, the annual income from her trust funds being 3 or 4 times as much as she was paid by J. Walter Thompson, advertisers. Since they were sleeping together, perhaps not here tonight, because McCoy would object to that,
but everywhere else, including a 3-month period when they cohabited on a yacht at the San Diego Yacht Club while he was training for what had now become the famous Macon Island raid, the trouble of her becoming impregnated was a real one. He had come to understand that the only reason she did not allow herself to become pregnant was that she was afraid of Ken, or else respected him too much to go against his wishes. And this, of course, meant that Ken McCoy was doing what he was unable to do as her father, guiding the course of her life. McCoy came into her life, perversely enough, through the young man Ernest Sage and his wife had hoped for years would become, in due time, her husband. If one ignored his current role as a Marine fighter pilot, with odds against his passing through the war unscathed or alive, this young man would have headed a list of desirable suitors. He came from a splendid family. His mother, who had been Ernie's mother's roommate and best friend at college, was the only daughter of Andrew Foster of Foster Hotels International. His father, an old friend whom Ernest Sage could never completely forgive for arranging for the yacht in San Diego, knowing full well what Ernie wanted it for, was Fleming Pickering, now wearing a Marine General's uniform, but previously Chairman of the Board and Chief Executive Officer of Pacific and Far East Shipping. Ken McCoy and Malcolm S. Pickering met and became buddies at Officer Candidate School at the Marine Corps base at Quantico, Virginia. Under graduation, Pick was sowing a few wild oats in a penthouse suite at the Foster Park Hotel on Central Park South, his one semi-disqualifying characteristic as the perfect suitor was his proclivity for wild oats sowing. Though Ernie unfortunately regarded Pick as a troublemaking brother, she somewhat reluctantly, at her father's urging, went to the party after he told her she was duty-bound to congratulate Pick on his second lieutenant's bar and to wish him well in pilot training. There she met Ken McCoy, sitting on a ledge, his feet dangling over 59th Street. 15 minutes later, they left the penthouse in search of Chinese food in Chinatown. One of the first things Ernie told her father about McCoy was that he spoke Chinese like a Chinaman. "Well, they look pretty clean," McCoy said, handing Mr. Sage the shotgun barrels. "But what you really need is some hops number 9. I'll get some for you." "When he sold me that stuff, the man at Griffin and Howe said it was the best barrel cleaner available," Ernest Sage heard himself say. "Why couldn't I have just said thank you? Am I looking for an excuse to fight with him?" "The best barrel cleaner is mercury," McCoy said matter-of-factly. "Next is hops number 9.
"Mercury? What the hell is he talking about, mercury?"
"Mercury? You stop up one end of a barrel, fill the barrel with mercury, let it stay a couple of minutes, and then pour it out. Takes the barrel right down to the bare metal. I guess it dissolves the lead and the primer residue, all the crap that fouls the barrel."
"Unfortunately, I suspect he knows what he's talking about. I will not challenge him on that. There probably is some chemical reaction vis-à-vis steel, copper, lead, and mercury." And then he heard himself say, "What you're saying is that the man at Griffin and Howe doesn't know what he's talking about?"
"Not if he said that stuff is best, he doesn't."
"Daddy," Ernie said, "Ken knows about guns. Why are you arguing with him?"
"I wasn't arguing with Ken, honey. I was just making sure I understood him correctly."
He fixed a smile on his face. "The next step in the sacred traditions of hunting around here is the ingestion of a stiff belt. How does that sound, Ken?"
"That sounds fine, sir."
Ernest Sage put the side-by-side Parker 12-bore together and then put it in a cabinet beside perhaps 20 other long arms. He turned and smiled at his daughter.
"I've been around guns all my life, but your Ken knows about guns, right?"
"Into the library, honey? Or shall we go in the kitchen and watch your mother defeather the birds?"
"The library," Ernie said. "Mother hates plucking and dressing birds. Always prays that you'll never get any pheasant."
"I've never eaten a pheasant," Ken McCoy said.
Really?
Ernest Page said. They went into the two-story-high library. The front of what looked like a row of books opened, revealing a bar, complete to refrigerator. Sage took two glasses and started to put ice in them.
Yes, Daddy, Ernie said. Thank you very much. I will have a drink, whatever you're having.
Sorry, honey, her father said. Excuse me, I'm not used to you being a full-grown woman. Make her a weak one, McCoy said. One strong drink and she starts dancing on tabletops. Sage turned in surprise in time to see Ernie sticking her tongue out at McCoy.
Don't believe him, Daddy.
He made the drinks and handed one to each of them.
What shall we drink to?
He asked. The fallen pheasants?
What about Pick? McCoy replied. I feel sorry for him.
Why do you feel sorry for him? Sage asked.
He's going on display on the West Coast right about now.
I don't understand.
A war bond tour. All the aviation heroes from Guadalcanal. Modesty is not one of his strong points, but I suspect the war bond tour will cure him of that.
Pick is a hero?
Certified. Got the DFC from the Secretary of the Navy himself last week.
I hadn't heard that.
For doing what he did with you?
Ernie asked. It was a challenge.
For being an ace. More than an ace. I think he has 6 kills, maybe 7.
What did she mean, Ken, for doing what he did with you? You saw Pick in the Pacific?
Yes, sir, I saw him in the Pacific.
If he got a medal, why didn't you?
Ernie demanded.
Because I didn't do anything to deserve a medal.
Huh,
Ernie snorted.
What exactly is it that you do in the Marines, Ken?
Ernest Sage asked with a smile. He knew that McCoy worked for Fleming Pickering. He didn't know what Pickering did for the Marine Corps. Pickering had told him he was the general in charge of mess kit repair, and he thought he probably was going to find out right now.
Well, right now I've been trying to make sure that the Navy doesn't steal everybody who speaks an Oriental language from the draft board for the Navy, that the Corps gets at least a few of them. I spent the last week at the Armed Forces Induction Center in New York.
I mean, ordinarily.
Whatever General Pickering tells me to do.
You're his assistant in charge of repairing mess kits, right?
Yes, sir, that's about it.
You're wasting your time, Daddy,
Ernie said.
I live with him, and he won't tell me anything either.
You had to say that. I live with him, didn't you? Maintaining a smile with some difficulty, Sage said,
I don't mean to pry, Ken. Would asking you how long you're going to be around be prying?
No, sir. I'll be around a long time, I think. 4, 5, maybe even 6 months.
Well, I suppose if you're young and in uniform, 5 or 6 months is a long time.
And then? They haven't told me.
And if they had, he wouldn't tell us, Ernie said, adding intensely, I really hate this goddamn war.
You are not too big to be told to watch your mouth, young lady.
What would you prefer, that I call it this noble enterprise to save the world for democracy?
That has a nice ring to it, McCoy said.
Oh, go to hell, Ernie said.
Ken McCoy did, in fact, know where he would be going in 4 to 6 months. He'd been told the week before. It was classified top secret. And he had been really impressed with what he would be doing, and with the long-range planning for the war the upper echelons of the military establishment were now carrying on. The Joint Chiefs of Staff intended to bomb the home islands of the Empire of Japan. Though the islands from which the planes would fly to attack Tokyo and other Japanese cities were now firmly in Japanese hands, the big brass was so sure that the war in the Pacific would see their capture that they had turned their attention to the details. One of the details was weather information. Without accurate weather predictions, including something called winds aloft, which McCoy had never heard of before last week, long-range bombing of Japan would not be possible. The ideal place to locate a weather reporting station would be as close to Japan as possible.
Since locating a weather station near Japan was out of the question, the next best place, for reasons not explained to McCoy, was the Gobi Desert in Mongolia. Until he had time to think about it, he was genuinely surprised that United States military personnel were presently in the Gobi Desert, which was about as far behind the enemy lines as it was possible to get. Though there were a few soldiers and sailors, the majority of them were United States Marines who had been stationed in Peking and elected not to surrender to the Japanese when the war began. They had made for the Gobi Desert for reasons that were not entirely clear, but that certainly included avoiding capture. They had taken with them a number of ex-China Marines, Yangtze River Patrol sailors, and members of the Army's 15th Infantry who had taken their retirement in China and considered themselves recalled from retirement. There was supposed to be 67 of them. They had established radio contact through American forces in China and were now in direct contact with Army and Navy radio stations in Hawaii, Australia, and the continental United States. They were ordered to maintain contact and to avoid capture, but not informed of the plans being made for them. Once they could be trained in a number of skills, including parachuting, it was planned that an initial reinforcement detachment would be sent to the Gobi Desert. In their number would be radio operators, meteorologists, cryptographers, and other technicians. Their ability to collect, encrypt, and transmit weather data from the Gobi would be tested, as would the efficacy of predicting weather from the data furnished. Inasmuch as the personnel in the Gobi were predominantly Marines, and the Marines were part of the Navy had been given overall command of the operation. The meteorologists, cryptographers, and communications personnel would be sailors, but the Secretary of the Navy, with the concurrence of the President's Chief of Staff, had given the Marine Corps Office of Management Analysis responsibility for staging the operation. The Deputy Chief of Management Analysis had in turn named Major Edward Banning as officer in charge, with Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy as his deputy. Nothing had been said to McCoy, but he knew that Banning held a magic clearance and thus could not be put in risk of capture, so Banning would not make the mission. He also felt quite sure that he himself would not become officer in charge by default. Command of the mission would not be entrusted to a lowly lieutenant. Consequently, sometime between now and the time the mission left the United States, a field grade officer would be assigned. But between now and then, he knew he would be in charge, turning to Banning only when he ran into a problem he could not handle himself. It would give him, as he had told Ernie and her father, 4 to 6 months in the States, and he was sure he could arrange his schedule to spend a good deal of time with her. Starting, he thought, almost immediately. He was about to go through the Marine Corps Parachutist School at Lakehurst, New Jersey. While he was there, he could go into New York City every night and every weekend, but he would also have to periodically return to Lakehurst to check on the progress of the others learning how to parachute themselves and their equipment from airplanes. The thought of parachuting into Mongolia was a little unnerving, but he told himself it was probably a good deal safer than being a platoon leader on Guadalcanal. The real problem with the Mongolian operation was that once he went in, it would be a long time before he could even think of getting out, perhaps not until the end of the war. But there was nothing he could do about that. 3. The Congressional Country Club, Fairfax County, Virginia, 1 November, 1942. Technically, the status of Major James C. Brownlee III, USMCR, at the Office of Strategic Services Reception and Training Station, the Pressed into Service Congressional Country Club, was agent awaiting assignment. That meant he had successfully completed the training program and passed the final board, a group of 5 senior OSS officers who had considered his military background, the comments of his training officers at the country club, and then called him in for an hour-long session to finally make the determination whether or not he was the sort of man who could successfully function behind the enemy's lines. Jim Brownlee,
a tall, blonde, slender 27-year-old who wore spectacles, had always wanted to be a Marine. While at Princeton, he participated in the Marine Corps Platoon Leaders Program, which was rather like the Army's Reserve Officer Training Corps. During the academic year, it exposed young men who thought they might like to be officers to courses with a military application. And then, during summer vacations, it gave them 6 weeks of intensive training in basic military subjects, the three M's, marching, marksmanship, and map reading, at U.S. Marine Corps Base Quantico, Virginia, and Parris Island Recruit Depot, South California. Jim Brownlee intended to apply for a commission in the regular Marine Corps, but his eyes did not meet the Marine Corps criteria for the regular service. Instead, on his graduation from Princeton in June 1937, he was commissioned as a second lieutenant, USMCR. After that, he went through the basic officer course at Quantico and was released to inactive duty. He joined Marine Corps Reserve Battalion 14, based in New Orleans, Louisiana, as a platoon leader, even though this meant an overnight train ride, at his own expense, each way once a month from his home in Palm Beach, Florida, for the weekend training program. After 2 years of service with the battalion, he was promoted first lieutenant. When he was not training with the Marine Corps, he was vice president, domestic transportation, for the Brownlee Fruit Company, founded by his grandfather, Matthew J. Brownlee. The firm imported bananas, their own production and brokered, from Nicaragua, Honduras, Panama, and San Salvador. His father was currently president, and his older brother, Matthew J. Brownlee III, was vice president, production. What his title meant was that his father had put him to work under an experienced, long-time traffic manager as a way to learn the business. Bananas were offloaded from Brownlee's ships at Port St. Lucie, Florida, Mobile, Alabama, and New Orleans, Louisiana. His job was to ensure the smooth flow of the bananas either to regional distribution centers or to the ultimate retailers. He liked the challenge of quickly and economically moving vast amounts of bananas. They are, of course, highly perishable, from the offloading port to their destinations, while keeping them as fresh as possible. At the same time, the intricacies of interstate motor freight laws, tariffs, and the like were rather fascinating. Since the whole idea was to teach him the business, he also spent a good deal of time in Central America with his brother. Matthew, who was 15 years older than he was, devoted his attention pretty much equally to showing Jim the plantation operations and trying to prevent him from giving in to what the Episcopal Church terms the sinful lusts of the flesh with dark-skinned native girls. On 15 October 1940, President Roosevelt ordered the mobilization of Marine Reserve battalions, which did not surprise Jim Brownlee. On April 9th, Germany had occupied Denmark and invaded Norway. The next month, Germany invaded Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, who had promised peace in our time, resigned 11 May, and Winston S. Churchill took his place. What was left of the British Army after the German blitzkrieg across France was evacuated from Dunkirk on 4 June, and just over a week later, the German Wehrmacht goose-stepped down the Champs-Élysées. On 22 June, the French surrendered to the Germans. In July, a Marine Lieutenant Colonel who spoke to Jim's reserve battalion in New Orleans brought them up to date on the military picture as the Marine Corps saw it. He mentioned that as of 30 June, the total strength of the USMC was 1,732 officers and 26,545 enlisted men. He didn't say that the Marine Reserve was about to be mobilized, but he did say that there were obviously not enough Marines in uniform for the present circumstances. Jim Brownlee reported for active duty with his reserve battalion to Marine Base Quantico, Virginia on 1 November 1940. Within a week of their arrival, the battalion was broken up, and its members were scattered all over the world, wherever Marines were serving. a Marine personnel officer, a major whom Jim correctly suspected was curious how a 24-year-old had become a vice president of a large corporation, questioned him at some length about his duties, and then sent him to see a full colonel, who was the G4 supply officer at Quantico. The colonel questioned him even more intensively about his knowledge of what the Marine Corps called transport. Apparently satisfied with the answers, he told Jim he had been looking for someone with his qualifications, and as of that moment, he could consider himself assigned to the G4 section as an assistant transportation officer. Jim's protests that he was trained as an infantry platoon leader were met with the observation that in the colonel's experience, good Marine officers went where they were sent and did what they were told to do without complaint. The year between Jim's call to active duty and Pearl Harbor went quickly, and he took a certain satisfaction from his work. He was more than a little surprised to learn how much truck operators serving the Marines had been able to get away with before he laid his expert eye on the invoices they had tendered. He received, during that year, 3 letters of commendation for his official file and a wholly unexpected promotion to captain. The attack on Pearl Harbor surprised him, for a couple of reasons. For one thing, he did not think the Japanese had the technical capability to strike with such strength at such a great distance. For another, though a surprise attack on the United States was possible, in his view, he thought it would probably come on the Panama Canal, either from the Germans in the Atlantic or the Japanese in the Pacific, or conceivably, both. On 8 December, he applied for transfer to duty with troops. His letter came back within a week, denied. He applied again thereafter on a monthly basis, and on a monthly basis his request was denied. In April 1942, he was promoted major. The ceremony was held in the office of the commanding general. After offering his congratulations, he said he hoped it would mean the end of the monthly requests for transfer. In May 1942, a memorandum from headquarters USMC crossed Major Brownlee's desk. Applications were being solicited from officers for a non-specified duty of an intelligence nature. Preference would be given to those with fluency in one or more foreign languages and/or who had spent time outside the continental United States. He submitted his application and promptly forgot about it, sure that it would suffer the same fate as his requests for transfer to duty with troops. 2 weeks later, his orders came through. He was transferred to something called the Office of Strategic Services and ordered to report within 48 hours to the National Institutes of Health Building in Washington, D.C. There, he was interviewed by another board of officers. This one consisted of 3 men in civilian clothing. 2 of them spoke Spanish. At the conclusion of the interview, one of the Spanish speakers shook his hand, offered his name, and said, "Please give my best regards to your brother, but don't tell him where or under what circumstances we bumped into each other." That same afternoon, Jim Brownlee was transported in a Buick station wagon to the former Congressional Country Club to begin training. The training was difficult, but not nearly so difficult for Major Brownlee as it was for some of his fellow trainees who had entered the OSS directly from civilian life. He had taken pains to keep himself in shape at Quantico and thereafter. 2 fellow trainees had never held a weapon in their hands before coming to the country club. As the training proceeded, he began to wonder where he would be assigned. He gradually came to the conclusion that because of his fluency in Spanish, it would either be in Spain or somewhere in South America. In Spain, the policy of the United States government was to keep Generalissimo Franco, known as El Caudillo, neutral. If South America, he rather suspected he would be in Argentina, where the military-dominated government was in everything but name an ally of the Germans. It was common knowledge around the country club that both the OSS and the FBI were deeply involved in Argentina, Chile, Paraguay, and Uruguay. There was a decent library at the country club, and Jim Brownlee spent many of his evenings trying to learn as much as he could about the history and politics of South America. He felt he would be given an assignment shortly after he completed the training and then got past the final board. That didn't happen. Despite his agent-awaiting-assignment status, no assignment was forthcoming. What did happen was that someone in the office realized that he was the senior Marine officer present at the country club, and consequently, that administrative responsibility for all Marine Corps personnel assigned to the OSS was logically his. At first, in what he believed was the interim between the completion of his training and his assignment, he didn't mind at all. For one thing, it gave him something to do, and he rather liked guiding fellow Marines through the rocks and shoals of country club training. But then, he began to worry if the same sort of thing that happened to him at Quantico was happening to him at the country club. Good administrators were hard to find, and more Marines had been accepted by the OSS. The last thing in the world he wanted was to be sort of a Marine mother hen. He wanted to get out on assignment and do something more concrete against the enemy than shepherd other Marines through training. He was no closer now to being what he thought of privately as a fighting Marine than he had been at Quantico. This awareness was made even more painful with the arrival at the country club of First Lieutenant Robert B. Macklin, USMC. Macklin was not only a rather handsome man, but his uniform and his person were adorned with the symbols of what Jim Brownlee wanted rather desperately to be, a fighting Marine. Macklin wore the ring of the United States Naval Academy at Annapolis. Colored ribbons on the breast of his well-fitting uniform indicated that he had seen service in the Pacific and that he had been twice wounded. His face was scarred from one wound, and his slight limp, which he tried but failed to hide, suggested that the wound that caused it had been more severe than the one on his face. He wore the wings of a parachutist, and when asked, he revealed that he had been wounded with the USMC 2nd Parachute Battalion storming the beach at Gavutu during the invasion of Guadalcanal. Brownlee had heard that the Marine paratroopers at Gavutu were literally decimated. 1 out of 10 paramarines were killed or wounded. "I really have only one question, Lieutenant," Brownlee said. "With all the service you've seen, I should have thought by now that you would be at least a captain." "The Major will note," Macklin replied, demonstrating impeccable military courtesy, "that my service records have been misplaced."
"Yes, of course," Brownlee said. "I'm sure they'll turn up."
Lieutenant Robert B. Macklin devoutly hoped they would not. He was delighted when a master gunner in officer personnel at 8th and I informed him that his records were missing, but they were going to send him to the OSS anyway and hope they turn up. With a little bit of luck, they wouldn't ever turn up, which meant the Corps would have to reconstruct a new set. With just a little more luck, the reconstructed records would not contain a copy of the devastating officer's efficiency report he had received from Captain Edward Banning, the S-2 of the 4th Marines in Shanghai. Lieutenant Macklin had given that efficiency report and its potential effect on his career a good deal of thought. Now that he had time to consider it, he was no longer surprised that Captain Edward J. Banning wrote all those despicable and untrue things about him. Under the circumstances, Macklin now realized, it was perfectly understandable that he did. For one thing, while Banning was a career officer, he did not graduate from the academy. If memory served, Banning went to the Citadel. If not the Citadel, then to VMI or Norwich, one of those quasi-professional private military colleges that for some reason, most likely political, were permitted to commission their graduates into the regular service. It was common knowledge that Norwich, Citadel, and VMI graduates were jealous of those who went to Annapolis and West Point, and that whenever the opportunity presented itself, they stuck knives into the unsuspecting backs of those who had that privilege. Furthermore, at the time, Banning's own career was in jeopardy, and he had no one to blame for that but himself. While the Citadel, or wherever he actually went, wasn't the academy, Banning must have had the opportunity to learn what would be expected of him in his personal life as a Marine officer. Teaching potential officers what would be expected of them was one of the major reasons the Army and the Navy sent West Point and Annapolis graduates to serve on the staffs of the private military schools. Becoming involved, as Captain Banning did, with a stateless person, a Russian woman, was conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman, in fact, if not in the law.
If the war hadn't come along, it would have meant the end of Banning's career, and he must have known that. Banning, furthermore, should have known better than to become close to an enlisted man, particularly one like Corporal Killer McCoy. McCoy was typical of the enlisted men in the 4th Marines, a product of the lower classes, obviously without a decent education. For those people, service in the Marines meant 3 square meals a day, a cot, and the opportunity to frequently fornicate with the native women. There are reasons for the line drawn between officers and enlisted men. Banning certainly knew about the line and the reasons for it, and he chose to ignore it. At the same time, it was perfectly clear that McCoy knew all about Banning's Russian mistress, and God only knows what other secrets Banning was hiding. That knowledge gave him a totally unacceptable advantage over an officer. And then, there was the matter of Lieutenant Ed Sessions' support of McCoy's outrageous charges. So far as that was concerned, it was, in fact, very disappointing. As a fellow graduate of the Academy, Sessions should have demonstrated at least a modicum of loyalty toward a fellow alumnus when that alumnus was under attack by an enlisted man. But Sessions not only knew that Banning was going to write his efficiency report, but that Banning had gone off the deep end where Killer McCoy was concerned and would take his enlisted buddy McCoy's word against anyone else's about what really happened. So he went along. The usual mechanism to keep personality conflicts out of efficiency reports was their review by a more senior officer. But that failed. Major Puller, the reviewing officer, already overworked preparing the 4th Marines' move to the Philippines, had the choice between believing Banning, whom he knew, and an officer who wasn't in their clique. It was as simple as that. His subsequent assignment as a mess officer at Quantico was, Macklin knew, a direct result of Banning's efficiency report. That sort of duty does not fall to graduates of the Naval Academy. But he resolved then to do the best job he could. And then, and he still found this incredible, Corporal Killer McCoy showed up at Quantico as an officer candidate. The only officer candidate in his class from the ranks. The only one who had not spent 2 weeks in a college classroom, much less taken a degree. In the matter of his encounter with McCoy at Quantico, Macklin was willing to admit that he made an error in judgment. On the one hand, obviously, he owed it to the Corps to do whatever was necessary to keep such a man from being commissioned. On the other hand, he should have approached the appropriate officer at the school and told him what he knew of McCoy from personal knowledge, information that made the notion of commissioning him an officer absurd on its face. His personal knowledge would reveal that McCoy was not only insubordinate and untruthful, but the reason he was known in China as Killer was that he had become embroiled in a barroom or brothel encounter with Italian Marines. He'd stabbed 2 of them fatally. Some sort of technicality kept him from getting what he deserved, 20 years to life in the Portsmouth Naval Prison. But clearly, a man with murderous instincts who wallowed in drunkenness and depravity was not qualified to be a Marine officer. At the time, however, doing something official did not seem to be the best course of action. His good intentions, his concern solely for the good of the Corps, it seemed at the time, might be misunderstood. If he had done something official, the question could very well have been raised, who is Lieutenant Macklin? His service records would have probably been examined, and they contained, of course, Banning's efficiency report. Until his performance of duty proved how unjust it was, the less frequently that efficiency report came to light, of course, the better. And, of course, as an officer and a gentleman, it was beneath him to bear Killer McCoy any ill will. It wasn't, in the final analysis, McCoy's fault that he was in officer candidate school. Banning had arranged for that, written him an absolutely unbelievable letter of recommendation. McCoy belonged in the ranks. In time, under the leadership of other officers, he would probably become a decent sergeant. So the thing to do was to get him back to the ranks. Failing to make it through officer candidate school, with his background, was to be expected. At the club, he spoke to one of McCoy's tactical officers. Without getting into specifics, he made it quite clear that commissioning Killer McCoy would be a disaster. That officer also believed it ill-advised, at the very least, to commission a high school graduate, and he seemed sympathetic to the idea of returning McCoy to the ranks by seeing that he failed officer candidate school, if not academically, then in the areas of potential leadership and character. That probably would have worked. However, at the time, it seemed a good idea that there be some failure on McCoy's part on the military aspects of the course. Arranging for McCoy to fail the course's marksmanship requirements seemed a good way to do that. Such a failure would do McCoy no lasting harm. As soon as he was back in the ranks, he would be given the opportunity to refire the standard course, and he could probably do that. In the meantime, he would be dropped from officer candidate school. But the post-sergeant major put his nose in where it properly had no place and challenged McCoy's rifle range scores. McCoy fired again for record and qualified as high expert. Shortly afterward, Macklin was called into the office of deputy school commandant, where he was told it would be in his best interests to apply for a transfer. There was no question in Macklin's mind that the sergeant major had gone to the deputy commandant, carrying tales about what he thought Macklin had been doing in the rifle range butts. His application for parachute duty was quickly approved. And from there, things moved quickly. First, they grew worse with the transfer to the Pacific and the invasion of Guadalcanal. It was only by the grace of God that he wasn't killed during the invasion. Quite literally, he missed death by inches. But then, in the hospital in Australia, where he was sent for treatment of his wounds, things started to get better. He was selected to participate in the first war bond tour as a wounded Guadalcanal veteran. He did so well dealing with the public that on the completion of Tour 1, the public relations people asked that he be permanently assigned to supervise Tour 2. The Marines sent on Tour 2 to encourage the civilian population to buy more war bonds and raise civilian morale were Guadalcanal aviation aces, pilots who had shot down at least 5 Japanese aircraft. But Macklin did not find these men impressive. He privately decided that most of them were disgraces to the Marine uniforms they wore. They were undisciplined, regarded military courtesy as a joke, and spent most of the tour making unwanted advances to women and drinking themselves into oblivion, and that aviators themselves were highly overrated. It was one thing to get out of a clean bed and climb into an airplane and fly for several hours and then possibly, but only, possibly, engage in a minute or two of combat before flying home to a hot meal in a dry bed. It was quite another to do what he had done, or would have done, had he not been wounded in the opening minutes of the assault, to make an assault in a landing barge through heavy fire onto an enemy-held beach, to hear the crack of machine gun fire and the scream of incoming artillery, and then to be called upon to lead men against a determined enemy. Those introspections had caused him to consider what would happen to him when Tour 2 was over. Thanks to that damned efficiency report, he was still a first lieutenant. In the Corps, first lieutenants command platoons. While he would, of course, go where he was sent and do what he was told to do, the idea of commanding a platoon in the assault of some hostile shore seemed a waste of his professional talents and experience. He should be a teacher. He had been there. He could make a genuine contribution to the Corps and probably save some lives as a teacher, preparing men and officers for what they would find when it was their turn to go into combat. If he just waited for the Corps to order him someplace, it would more than likely be to one of the newly formed divisions, where he would be just one more platoon leader. He had been trying to think of some way to make the personnel people aware of his unusual talents and experience and the contribution he could thus make. He got so far as drafting several letters when the memorandum vis-à-vis special assignment to intelligence duties came to hand. It seemed to be just what he was looking for. Not only did he have the qualifications and experience, there weren't very many people around who could say they had intelligence-gathering experience in the Orient, but it seemed, with that in mind, that he could be utilized as an instructor. It was clearly a waste of assets to send someone like himself into, so to speak, the lines, when he could make a far greater contribution to the war effort by training others. When he was so quickly accepted, he thought perhaps his luck was changing. When he learned that his service records had been misplaced,
he felt certain that Lady Luck was finally smiling at him. 4. Office of the Assistant Chief of Staff, G1, Headquarters, United States Marine Corps, 8th and I Streets, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 0945 hours, 2 November, 1942.
Good morning, sir.
Master Gunner James L. Hardy, USMC, said to the tall, blonde, bespectacled, and lost-looking Major.
May I help you?
God, I hope so, Gunner, Major James C. Brownlee replied, smiling.
The difficult takes some time, Gunner Hardy said. The impossible usually turns out to be impossible.
Brownlee chuckled and offered his hand. My name is Brownlee, he said.
Hardy, sir. What can we do for you?
I'm trying to get an officer promoted, Brownlee said.
You and everybody else in the Corps, Hardy said,
waving toward a section of his office where two typists, working under the eagle eye of a staff sergeant, were typing mimeograph stencils.
That's just about the end of last week's promotions, he went on. Tomorrow, we start this week's.
I'm not in personnel, Brownlee said, so my ignorance of the process is complete and overwhelming.
You're not part of our happy family here at 8th and I, Major?
No, I'm not, Brownlee said. Tell me, Gunner, what does it usually take to get a first lieutenant promoted to captain?
Well, presuming a first lieutenant can see lightning and hear thunder, isn't under charges, and has 24 months in grade, and that's about to drop, it's now nearly automatic.
Hardy gestured again toward the hard-working typists. I thought it was probably something like that, Brownlee said. Gunner, what it is that I have sort of a responsibility for an officer, a first lieutenant.
Sort of a responsibility, sir?
Hardy asked, confused. The thing is, Gunner, Brownlee said, a little uncomfortably, I'm with a rather unconventional unit.
Which one would that be, sir?
Hardy asked. He was beginning to suspect that he was not going to enjoy this encounter. I'm with the OSS to put a point on it, Brownlee said, and the chain of command is a little fuzzy in the OSS. Master Gunner Hardy was not an admirer of the OSS, about which he knew little except that the service records of a couple of hundred officers who had volunteered for it had crossed his desk. Hardy had nearly 30 years in the Corps. So far as he was concerned, the officer personnel requirements of the Corps obviously should come first, and with the to-be-expected exceptions to that rule, like that sea lawyer Hero Macklin a couple of days ago, here they were sending what looked to him like good officers to the OSS at a time when the Corps was up Schitt's Creek without a paddle trying to find officers to staff a Marine Corps that was growing larger than anyone ever thought it would.
So I hear, Hardy said. Exactly how can I help you, Major?
I'm the senior Marine officer at the OSS Reception Center, Brownlee said. Yesterday, an officer, a First Lieutenant Macklin...
Oh, shit.
...was transferred in. I generally go over the records of people coming into the OSS. Marines, I mean, to make sure everything is ship-shape.
Yes, sir.
And I went over Lieutenant Macklin's records. Well, that's not exactly true. His records have been misplaced or possibly lost, probably at Guadalcanal. In fact, Master Gunner Hardy knew the service record of First Lieutenant Macklin, Robert B., USMC, was 30 feet away, filed under the R's in a file cabinet devoted to those officers. Absent, sick, in hospital. The reason he knew this to be true was that he himself had put them there, in a place where he, but no one else, could readily lay his hands on them.
Is that so?
I suppose that happens all the time, Brownlee said.
Yes, sir, it's not at all unusual.
This officer is one hell of a Marine, Gunner.
One hell of an asshole of a Marine is the way I hear it.
He was twice wounded at Guadalcanal, storming the beaches during the invasion.
Yes, sir.
As a matter of fact, he was one of the heroes the Corps sent back from over there for the war bond tour.
Is that so?
From what you've told me, Gunner, his promotion to captain should have come along by now, more or less automatically.
You and your fucking big mouth, Hardy. You, think so, sir?
Well, he's got the 24 months in grade you mentioned, and then some. And even though his records have been misplaced, I think we can give him the benefit of the doubt about not being under charges, can't we?
Sure we can, sir.
I had to be in Washington today, Gunner, Brownlee said. What I'd hoped I would be able to do here is see if we can't find his records and get him promoted, as he deserves.
As you said, Major, his missing records do pose a problem. I can tell you I'll keep a sharp eye out for them, now that you brought this to my attention.
I'd really hate to go to the Inspector General with this, Gunner.
Oh, shit. That's all we need in here, the Inspector General running around trying to do right by this goddamn Marine hero.
Because of the administrative problems that would inevitably cause.
I understand, sir. And if I have to find this asshole's records, that would mean I would have to send them over to the OSS, where, after one look at this bastard's efficiency reports, they'd boot him out so fast it would take 2 weeks for his asshole to catch up with him. And it would also be pretty embarrassing for Colonel Wilson, personally and officially. Major, how long are you going to be in Washington?
Master Gunner Hardy asked. I'm going to leave about 1600.
Do you suppose it would be possible for you to come by here, say, at 1500? Let me look into this myself and see what I can turn up.
That would be great, Major Brownlee said happily. Thank you very much, Gunner.
Oh, my pleasure, sir.
As soon as Major Brownlee had left the office, Gunner Hardy went to the R section of the Absent Sick in Hospital file cabinet. He briefly examined a service record it contained, made a note of Macklin's full name and serial number, and then went to the corner of the room where the two typists were preparing mimeograph stencils of last week's promotion list. He tapped the staff sergeant supervising the operation on the shoulder, and when he turned, said,
"One more for the captain's list."
"It's already done, Mr. Hardy."
"Do it again."
"Already printed and everything," the staff sergeant pleaded.
"Do it again," Hardy repeated.
"Aye, aye, sir. Where's the records?"
"I'll take care of his records. You just get his goddamn name on the goddamned orders."
"Aye, aye, sir." When Major James C. Brownlee returned to the office at 1600 hours, Master Gunner Hardy told him that while he had been unable to locate Lieutenant Macklin's records, he was still working on that, he had arranged to deal with the problem of his overdue promotion. He gave Major Brownlee a copy of the promotion orders so fresh from the mimeograph machine that the ink was a little wet. Colonel David M. Wilson, USMC Deputy Assistant Chief of Staff G1 for Officer Personnel, never heard a thing about it. Major James C. Brownlee's belief that master gunners were the people to see when you had a problem was reinforced. Captain Robert B. Macklin, USMC, was of course delighted to receive his long overdue and, in his opinion, richly deserved promotion. Master Gunner James L. Hardy, who had been on the water wagon for 6 months, went to a bar in Georgetown that night and got very drunk. 5. Top Secret. Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO, Navy Department, Washington, D.C. Via special channel, duplication forbidden, original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. Eyes only, the Secretary of the Navy. Brisbane, Australia, Monday, 2 November 1942. Dear Frank, I think I have gotten to the bottom of why El Supremo shows no interest at all in this fellow Fertig in the Philippines. I'm not going to waste your time telling you about it, but it's nonsense. Admiral Leahy is right. There is potential there, and I think Rickaby's people should be involved from the start. I'm going to tell Rickaby to come to you if he encounters trouble doing what I think he has to do. I suspect he will encounter the same kind of parochial nonsense among the professional warriors in Washington that I have encountered here. I have been butting my head, vis-a-vis Donovan's people, against the palace wall so often and so long that it's bloody, and am getting nowhere. Is there any chance I can stop? It would take a direct order from Roosevelt to make him change his mind, and then they will drag their feet, at which, you may have noticed, they're very good. More soon. Best regards, Fleming Pickering, Brigadier General, USMCR, top secret. Top secret. Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO, Navy Department, Washington, D.C. Via special channel, duplication forbidden. Original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. For Colonel F. L. Rickaby, USMC Office of Management Analysis. Brisbane, Australia, Monday, 2 November 1942. Dear Fritz, don't tell him yet, or even Banning, but I want you to try to find a suitable replacement for McCoy for the Mongolian operation. Put him and Banning to work finding out about guerrilla operations, because I believe that this Wendell Fertig in the Philippines is probably going to turn out more useful than anybody in the palace here is willing to even consider. I suspect that the same mental attitude vis-a-vis unconventional warriors and the competence of reserve officers is prevalent in Washington. This idea has Leahy's backing, so if you encounter any trouble, feel free to go to Frank Knox. If you can do it without making any waves, please, A, see if you can find out where my son is being assigned after the war bond tour, and B, tell me if telling his mother would really endanger the entire war effort. She went to see Jack NMI Stecker's boy at the hospital in Pearl and is in pretty bad shape. Koffler is getting married next week, for a little good news. I decided I had the authority to make him a staff sergeant and have done so. Regards, Fleming Pickering, Brigadier General, USMCR. Top Secret. Part 8. 1. Water Lily Cottage, Brisbane, Australia. 0815 hours, 9 November 1942. When he walked into the kitchen of the rambling frame house, the term cottage he had decided when he rented the place was another manifestation of Australian-British understatement, Brigadier General Fleming W. Pickering, USMCR, obviously fresh from his shower, was wearing a pale blue silk dressing gown that reached almost to his bare feet. He went to the stove, poured himself a mug of coffee, and then sat on a high stool at the kitchen table. A tall, muscular, deeply tanned man of the same age, wearing a khaki shirt and marine green trousers, was already sitting at the table. Something about him suggested illness and/or exhaustion. For a moment, they quietly examined each other without expression. "Sergeant Stecker," Pickering finally said, "you realize that you and I did not set a good example for the men last night. I trust you are properly ashamed of yourself?" Lieutenant Colonel Jack NMI Stecker, USMCR, who had the previous day flown into Brisbane from Guadalcanal, chuckled. Then he replied slowly, with a smile, "Don't worry about it, Corporal Pickering. I don't think anyone was in any condition to notice." Pickering looked at his old friend with affection and concern. They had once, a generation before, in a previous war in France, actually been Sergeant Stecker and Corporal Pickering. "God, I hope so, Jack. I haven't been that plastered in years."
"I used to think I could handle my liquor," Stecker said.
"Well, that was before we got old," Pickering said.
"Or started drinking with the Coast Watchers. In particular, the head Coast Watcher," Stecker said. "I think that is the root of our problem. With the honor of the Corps at stake, I tried to match Commander Felt drink for drink. That was a colossal error in judgment."
"Well, no real harm done. And I suspect that the newlyweds will remember their reception for a long time."
"Probably not too fondly," Stecker said. "They're nice kids, aren't they? Staff Sergeant Koffler doesn't look old enough to be a father-to-be, or a staff sergeant, or to have done what he did on Buka. And the bride looked a little younger."
"I don't think they come much better," Pickering said. "I was about to ask where the hell the cook is, but on reflection, I'm not sure I'm up to looking a couple of sunny-side-up eggs in the face."
"I have been sitting here wondering whether a little hair of the dog would make me feel better."
What was your conclusion?"
"I don't want to breathe fumes on the senior marine officer aboard when I report for duty."
"What?"
"His name is Mitchell. Do you know him?"
Pickering nodded.
Oh, yes, I know Colonel Lewis R. Mitchell, he said, not very pleasantly. The special liaison officer between Sink Pack and Sweep Po. What do you mean you have to report to him? He's the senior marine officer at Sweep Po. I'm supposed to coordinate with him. Fuck Mitchell. Stay away from him. I don't see how I can, Flem. Anyway, what have you got against him?
Well, for one thing, the minute the pompous son of a bitch showed up here, he tried to tell Eric Felt how to run the Coast Watcher organizer, and walked all over Ed Banning in the process. I heard about it, and had Forrest send him a radio telling him in some very plain language to butt the hell out of our business.
Major General Horace W. T. Forrest was Assistant Chief of Staff, G2, Headquarters, USMC. Second Lieutenant George F. Hart, USMCR, his chest and biceps straining the material of his skivvy shirt, came into the kitchen.
Good morning, General, Hart said. Colonel, I thought I heard something in here.
What you probably heard was my stomach growling, Pickering said.
George, get on the horn. Present my compliments to Colonel Mitchell and tell him that I will be coordinating Colonel Stecker's activities at Sweep Po. And, on your way back in here, bring a bottle of Crevassier. Colonel Stecker and I require a medicinal dose.
Aye, aye, sir.
And if you feel the need, George, have one yourself, but just one. You're going to help Colonel Stecker move his things from the BOQ here.
Aye, aye, sir, Hart said.
Welcome to Water Lily Cottage, Colonel.
Stecker smiled uneasily, but waited until Hart had left the room before speaking.
I think we had better think about my moving in here, Flem. I don't know what you're doing here.
For one thing, I'm the senior marine around here, so don't argue with me, Colonel.
Except that it's highly classified.
You don't look like a Japanese spy to me. Just don't ask too many questions, Jack.
I don't want to be in the way.
If you would be in the way, Jack, I wouldn't have asked you to move in, Pickering said. And I need you. With all these kids around, I feel like I'm trapped in a fraternity house. I need someone my own age to keep me company.
Stecker looked as if he was framing a reply.
Changing the subject, Colonel, Pickering said. Through the haze, I seem to recall that we discussed guerrilla operations at some time last night. Do you remember what you said? And if so, would you mind repeating it?
Stecker looked at him in surprise, then thought aloud.
You're serious, aren't you?
Yes, I am. What was it you said about the ratio between the strength of a guerrilla force and conventional forces required to contain them?
What I said? And Fleming, I don't regard myself as any kind of an expert on this.
How long were you involved down in the Banana Republics? Pickering interrupted.
I did 3 tours in Nicaragua and 2 in Haiti. So did a lot of other people. Chesty Puller, Lou Diamond.
Until somebody comes along with more experience than you have, you're my expert, Pickering said. Go on, please, Jack.
What I said was that when the Corps was in Haiti and Nicaragua, we used to say that one guerrilla tied up 7 Marines.
Define a guerrilla for me.
Stecker considered his reply before giving it.
An armed man who was willing to take a risk to make things difficult for an occupying force.
Define difficult.
Anything from ambushing his supply lines, blowing up his supply dumps, denying him the use of roads unless he sends large military forces to guard his convoys to... I don't know quite how to put this. Making him look bad, incompetent, ineffective in the eyes of the native population.
One guerrilla ties up 7 men, Pickering quoted thoughtfully.
At least 7. I always thought that it was closer to 10. We outnumbered the bandidos in Nicaragua 10-1, and they gave us a lot of trouble.
What sort of supplies does a guerrilla need?
A good guerrilla operation lives off the land, like the Chinese communists do. Getting the civilians, without antagonizing them, to provide food and shelter and intelligence. Paying for it, if at all possible. Aside from that... Nothing but the basics, the 3 Bs, boots, bullets, and beans.
Is there a racial factor?
What do you mean?
In the Banana Republics, the guerrillas came from the native population. It was the brown man against white gringos. Is that right?
Yes, I suppose it is.
in the Philippines.